Okay, so as advertised, this is first of all the last shiur of the season. So during the summer, people just have to review the notes and go over everything. It's a long, it's a late Rosh Hashanah this year. The truth is, it's a little bit of a misnomer. Rosh Hashanah will be when it always is on Aleph Tishrei, but just in terms of the secular calendar, so we have a lot of time between the end of the summer, the bungalow season, and the beginning of Rosh Hashanah. So Be'ezus Hashem, probably the Sunday after Labor Day, if I had to guess, you know, we'll start up, all things being equal, unless there's Simcha or something of that nature. We'll figure it out as we get closer to September as to the exact timing. But Be'ezus Hashem, we'll be able to get in a few shiurim prior to Rosh Hashanah. What I wanted to speak about today is a Shavuos-related topic, and specifically to focus on the following question in Megillas Rus. We know that Rus is the prototype of a Gioras Tzedek, of a woman who converts in the most beautiful and righteous way possible. What's a little unclear going through Megillas Rus is at which point in the story exactly is Rus Megaya? At which point does she actually convert to Judaism? And to phrase the question, to appreciate the complexity of the question, let's just throw out a couple of factors. Certainly the Pasuk says, on the one hand, that when Mahlon and Kilion married wives in Moab, they married Nashim Moavios. The Pasuk says that they married Moabite wives, which makes it sound like Rus and Orpah were not yet Jewish when Mahlon and Kilion married them. It's not exactly clear at what point Rus does become Jewish. In other words, we don't find any Beis Din meeting scheduled or anything of that nature described in Megillas Rus. We also do find at the very end of the Sefer that Rus is referred to as Eishes Mahlon. At the very end of the Sefer, when there's a discussion about who's going to marry Rus, and in the course of marrying Rus also inherit the land that used to belong to Mahlon. And again, that's a discussion between this individual by the name of Tov, according to Chazal, and Boaz himself. Boaz ends up marrying Rus. So the whole discussion between Boaz and that individual assumes that Rus is Eishes Mahlon. That's the way she's described in the Pasuk. Now, otherwise we're nothing to talk about over there. Now, if Rus was not Jewish the entire time that she was married to Mahlon, so although in a colloquial sense she may be described as Eishes Mahlon, but certainly in a halachic sense, the marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew has no halachic significance whatsoever. They're not considered to be married. So how on the one hand could she have been non-Jewish when she was married to Mahlon, and on the other hand be described as Eishes Mahlon, the wife of Mahlon, later on in the Sefer? What's more, Chazal indicate that Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion were Gedolei Hador. They were people of tremendous stature. And the notion that people of that stature would be so careless about either intermarrying themselves or allowing their sons to intermarry, just, again, you know, you live long enough, nothing's impossible, but it certainly does seem to boggle the mind a little bit that people of that stature would marry non-Jewish women. So to try to address this question, again, when exactly did Rus convert, we're going to get into a bunch of different makaros, a bunch of different sources, and we'll see that the issue seems to be a machlokas, a dispute within Chazal. It's certainly a dispute within the Rishonim, the medieval commentators, and we'll see two very innovative ways of trying to reconcile all the opinions in such a way that they both did convert and didn't convert in a certain sense prior to marrying Mahlon and Kilion. First of all, let's just acknowledge that there seem to be different positions in Chazal themselves as to when exactly Rus and maybe Orpah, you know, converted to Judaism. So there seems to be a lot of evidence, as per the Pasuk, that that there was no conversion that took place before Rus and Orpah married Mahlon and Kilion. And that in fact, you know, when Machlon and Kilian passed away, Ruth and Orpah were still 1,000% non-Jewish. That is indicated by Chazal in the Medrash Rus Rabbah. Parsha Beis Piska Test, we read, Tani B'Shem Reb Meir, we learn in the name of Reb Meir, Lo Girum, when Machlon and Kilion married Rus and Orpah, they did not convert them, V'lo Hitbilu Osam, and they did not go to a mikvah. You know, there was nothing. They married Noshim O'Avios, they married non-Jewish women, Shuto Kimashmo, in the simple sense of the term.
That,
what's that? Oh, okay. So then we'll have to figure out how you deal with Eishes Machlon, you know, Eishes Machlon at the end of the Megillah. But, you know, one thing which is clear is that, you know, this passage in Chazal seems to say pretty clearly that... Right, right. So in other words, what you have to end up saying probably, according to this approach, is that Eishes Machlon is meant in a colloquial sense, not a real halachic sense. And the truth is that even Tov has no real halachic obligation, you know, vis-a-vis Rus, because they're not, you know, they're not considered to be related in any way. It's just sort of in the sense of, it would be a nice thing to do, being that, in a colloquial sense, Rus and Machlon had a relationship. You know, it would be nice to try to step in there, you know, and help Rus out, because in the end of the day, she did convert.
And also, I think,
yeah,
the way they keep holding Moabios to me is very significant. It's not just non-Jewish.
Right.
And even the fact that they left the land, I would think of it as if you were living in the 1953, and
right,
someone who was so hard in Israel, and they left to go live in Germany.
Right.
It's like they
right
left to the place where
right
it's
betrayal
people that
right
were really
right
iced on
right
colloquially.
Right.
So he doesn't just say it's not just non-Jewish.
Right. Right.
They keep using that word because it was
right
the choice that they made.
Right, right, right. So Be'ez Hashem, we'll come back to that point, you know, that what was so terrible about what they did may go beyond the fact that they intermarried, but there may be sort of a betrayal of Klal Yisrael in terms of what they did. Right. There are other sources as well in Chazal that seem to indicate that that Rus and Orpah did not convert prior to marrying Machlon and Kilion. The famous halacha, quote unquote, about Geirus that everybody knows, namely that you have to turn away a potential ger or georis three times, is found in the Medrash of Megillas Rus, and it's associated with Naomi's speech to Rus and Orpah, where she says to them three times, Shovna, go back. So clearly the understanding of that Medrash is that when Naomi is speaking to Rus and Orpah, go back, go back, go back, they're not yet converted, because if they had converted already, it would seem to be strange and wrong to dissuade them from coming with her to Eretz Yisrael and from keeping the mitzvahs properly. But by the way, we should point out that halacha, which everybody knows, that you're supposed to try to dissuade a ger or georis three times, only appears in this medrash. It's not mentioned in the Rambam or the Shulchan Aruch or any of the other classic sources. It doesn't. That's why I said it's a halacha in quotes, so to speak. You know, it's the one thing that everybody knows, but you know, it's not clear that that's actually a requirement in the strict sense of the term. But it is mentioned in this medrash in Megillas Rus. Right.
Her children marry
right
her again.
Right, right, which is also very, very strange.
Die again.
Right, right. Also a very, very strange line. If we have a chance, we may come back to that line also, because there's what to talk about in that line. Finally, the Gemara in Masechta Yevamos, which talks about the halachos of Geirus, learns out part of the procedure of Geirus from Naomi's discussion with Rus. When Naomi discusses with Rus, you know, do you really want to stick with me? Do you really want to stick with the Jewish people? Chazal learned out from there all of the requirement that the potential ger giyaris be informed of all of the mitzvahs, or a smattering of the mitzvahs, and be prepared to accept all of the mitzvahs prior to being megayir. So again, clearly that conversation is taking place after Machlon and Kilion have already passed away, and yet the Gemara is learning out from there a portion of the geirus procedure. It seems to indicate that Rus's geirus is only beginning at that point, and that she was not megayir at any point before marrying Machlom. So that's on the one hand. You have those sources in Chazal that seem to indicate that the Gerus only took place later. Again, it's not quite clear when the Gerus takes place, but it seems pretty clear that it was not before the marriage, and you know, not even by the time that Machlon and Kilion had passed away. On the other hand, there are sources in Chazal that seem to understand the opposite, that there was a Gerus that took place before the marriage. So the Zohar Chadosh, to take one example thereof, the Zohar Chadosh asks the following question. Rus kevon shenis gaira mipnei malo kra'u b'shem acher. When Rus was megayir, how come she didn't take on a different name, a Jewish name? A convert is supposed to take on a Jewish name. So how come Rus didn't take on a Jewish name? So Amar le kach shomati. So the response in the Zohar Chadosh is, I've heard as follows, the Shem Acher Hayolah. The truth is, Rus was not her given name at birth. She had another name. I don't know, Nicolette, I don't know. Right? Or Shenises leMachlon, when Rus married Machlon, Karu Shma Rus. They called her name Rus. So in other words, the implication seems to be that Rus was Megayer shortly before marrying Machlon, and at that time she took on Rus, the name Rus, which is a Jewish name. In other words, that was part of her conversion procedure that she did prior to marrying Machlon. Right? And later on, the Zohar Chadosh writes that, in fact, we know what her name was before she was Megayer. Shomato mashma betchila. Do you know what her name was before she was Megayer? Amala Gilis Shema. Her name was Gilis. Ukshinasa Machlon kara lishma Rus. But when she married Machlon, which again seems to have taken place very, very soon after some kind of conversion, so then, you know, her name was changed to Rus to indicate the fact that she had been Megayer and joined Klal Yisrael. Right.
If they were Megayer, so have to come back and only say, oh,
and
go back to your
life. Right. So each approach solves some questions and leaves open and presents new questions, because that's a fundamental question. Right. Okay. But you know, that raises other questions. So in other words, so let's assume that Rus and Orpah, right? Because in other words, if they were Megayer before the marriage, it seems like it was a two for one. In other words, both Rus and Orpah were Megayer before they married Machlon and Kilion respectively. Okay. So now you have these two Gioros. These two Gioros, who unfortunately became almanos, they became widows by the passing of their husbands. So now you would think that the right thing to do halachically is for Naomi to say, we're going back to Eretz Yisrael. Of course you should come. Right? Of course you should come. Of course you should keep the mitzvahs. Of course you should, you know, be part of the Jewish people.
Don't we have timeness in Chazal? We see that there was timeness to all folks. She turned her neck on it, she turned her back.
Right.
That would indicate that, like, if she wasn't the guy, then what was so terrible?
Right. So that also, right. That seems to go into the camp of she wasn't Megayer, but it was the whole attempt. The whole attempt of Naomi to dissuade Rus and Orpah from coming back seems to indicate that they were not Megayer, because again, if they were Megayer, it would seem halachically the proper thing would be to say, right, you know, in other words, I'm not going to leave you in Moab. What kind of Jewish community is there here in Moab? You know, come with me to Eretz Israel. We'll get settled in Eretz Israel, and we'll do that. And the statement, you know, that Naomi makes to them, you know, if I had other sons, you know, would you wait to marry them? Implying that, you know, if you were okay with that, you could wait around to marry them. Seems to imply that they were Jewish already, Rus and Orpah, because otherwise, why is Naomi offering up her unborn sons to Rus and Orpah? Now again, right? Okay, maybe it's just poetic. Again, it's easy to offer up something that doesn't exist yet, right? But again, it does seem to indicate that would be okay if it, you know, if they were to wait around, that would be an option. Why is that an option? You know.
You know, maybe it wasn't halachic that she was thinking. Maybe she was just thinking, oh my gosh, what kind of a life am I going to have? I have to go back to Eretz Yisrael. But, you know, maybe they would be better off if they, you know, didn't come with me. Like, she wasn't talking out of halacha, she was talking out of compassion. you know, in her distraught way of, you know, because she was so distraught, I'm sure, to some husband, you know, the whole nine yards.
Right, but she also encourages them, go back to your gods. So that's a little bit harder. If they were in Taka Magaya by that time, to say go back to your gods, you know, is really problematic. You know, to tell somebody who is a true convert. So this same ambiguity that we find in Chazal reflects itself later on in history among the Rishonim. The Chazal are a little less explicit about it, but the Rishonim are very explicit about it. Rashi in Megillas Rus writes explicitly that Rus and Orpah were not Megaya prior to marrying Machlon and Kilion. The Baal HaAkedah writes similarly. On the other hand, the Ibn Ezra and the Ralbag both write explicitly that, of course, Rus and Orpah were Megaya prior to marrying Machlon and Kilion. In the words of the Ibn Ezra, V'lo yitochein sheyichu Machlon v'Kilion elu hanoshim ad sheyisgayru. It is impossible to say that Machlon and Kilion would have married these women without there being some kind of conversion process that they underwent. So it's clear that they must have been Megayer before marrying Machlon and Kilion. Again, you see both positions in Rishonim, but again, as we said before, each position, as much as it answers certain questions, it raises new questions.
Does it mean that they were half Megayer? No, the idea that they would say, listen, we're going to raise our children Jewish, we're going to marry,
Right. So that raises the question: if they were Megayer, they did everything right. So what was the punishment of Machlon and Kilion? Right. So what I want to try to present today are two approaches to try to, in a sense, have one's cake and eat it too. With regards to this question, I mean, it's clear that saying that they converted prior to the marriage raises problems. It's clear that saying that they did not convert prior to the marriage raises other problems. Is there somehow a way to say that they converted but didn't convert? You know, they did but they didn't.
Yeah. Say, let's say that they were in the process of converting.
Yeah.
Would it have been okay for a Jew to marry?
Yeah, so as the halachic expression goes, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. You know, in other words, you know, half a giyoras is still not a giyoras, right? In other words, it's not over. You know, we'll leave out the identity of the lady in question, as well as putting aside any issues of kolishta. But you know, that does seem to be the issue over here, right? Listen, it ain't over till it's over. You know, until the actual conversion takes place, that they're not converted. But is there some way to have our cake and eat it too, so to speak? So here I wanted to present two approaches. One from a sefer which I picked up while I was in Eretz Yisrael, called Ger HaMizgayer. This two-volume sefer is authored by one of the Ramim, one of the Rebbeim in Kerem B'Yavna in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Uri Bezalel Fisher. So while I was there visiting Karen B. Avnus, I had the opportunity to meet him and to purchase the Sefer, and he has essays about all different aspects of Geirus, including one essay on when exactly Rus was Megayer, going through all of these different sources. In this essay, Rabbi Fisher wants to try to present the following approach, which he notes afterwards. Rav Moshe Sternbach also notes a similar, not exactly the same, but a similar kind of approach in his Svarim. And the approach goes as follows. The Gemara in Masechet Ksubos introduces a very unusual kind of gear, a very unusual kind of conversion, known as the Geirus of a Katan, the Geirus of a minor. And the Gemara there in Ksubos, Daf Yud Aleph, makes the following interesting statement about the Geirus of a Katan. A katan, a child who's under bar bas mitzvah, who converts, is the nature of the conversion is that it's somewhat in suspension until the child becomes an adult. Again, think about it. A couple adopts a child. The child is 6 months old. Right? They sit the child down in front of the bezdin. They start, you know, interrogating the child. What do you know about Shabbos? What do you know about kashrus? You know, do you know your brachas? Again, you know, every parent would like to think that every Jewish parent certainly would like to think that their child is brilliant, you know, and he cooed in just such a way, you know, so clearly he was trying to say that, you know, the bracha is the shahakol, you know, that's clearly what he was trying to say. But, you know, in all likelihood, the Beis Din is not really going to be able to elicit from this genius 6-month-old a proper understanding of the mitzvahs or kabbalah sol mitzvahs. So the, you know, the Gemara says that you can immerse the child in a mikvah al da'as Beis Din, with the Beis Din understanding that the family is going to raise this child to be a shomer Torah mitzvahs. But in the end of the day, the child has to acquiesce to a life of Torah mitzvahs. So when the child turns 12 for a girl or 13 for a boy, the child has to be aware of the fact that they were converted as a child. They have to know that they have the option of backing out if they so choose. And if they choose to continue in a life of Torah mitzvahs at the age of 12 or 13, so then that locks in the gerus forever and ever. But otherwise, if they choose not to continue in that path, so it undoes retroactively the gerus that happened, and it's as if it never happened.
Isn't there also a thing that somebody wants to get married and convert to get married, they don't do that?
In which case? What do you mean?
Let's say somebody's dating a non-Jewish girl,
yeah,
and then in order to get married, she'll just do some kind of a conversion.
Okay, so we'll maybe talk about that in a little bit. Let's first talk about the Gerus Katan case. So, again, this is an unusual aspect of Gerus, because generally speaking, we assume that if a person is Megayer properly, the Gerus is absolute, and even if a month after the Gerus, the Ger decides that he's going to give up his connection to Judaism, it's tragic, but it's no different than a born Jew who, quote-unquote, went off the derech. In other words, once the person was megayer properly, their failure to keep Torah mitzvahs afterwards is tragic, but doesn't undo the gerus retroactively. The one situation where the gerus is undone retroactively is in the case where the person was megayer as a child. They didn't have the requisite understanding to accept Torah mitzvahs properly. So, you know, the question of whether the gerus is a good gerus or not a good gerus is something that is only really determined once the child reaches an age of majority, i.e. bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah. So Rabbi Fischer wants to suggest that maybe a way to reconcile all of the different statements about the status of the conversion of Rus is to suggest that maybe Elimelech took Rus and Arpah to be wives for his children, Mahlon and Kilion, when they were still under Bas Mitzvah. Now, so in 2019, we say, okay, we don't do that kind of stuff, you know, I mean, a child bride. But the truth is, for much of history, even till relatively recently, the notion of a girl under Bas Mitzvah getting married because it was advantageous for her to do so was not a
promise,
but sometimes even married. I mean, we know there's a discussion, you know, in many, many Gemaras about a father marrying off his daughter while she's still less than Bas Mitzvah. It was a not uncommon occurrence for much of history.
What about the mothers of these two, of, you know, Rus and Arpah?
What about?
They certainly were Moabite, so
right.
They wouldn't want to be converted.
Consider the following scenario. Rabbi Fischer builds this case based on other statements in Chazal. Again, to be very clear, Chazal do not say explicitly by any stretch of the imagination that Rus and Arpah got married to Mahlon and Kilion while they were still Ketanos, while they were still under Bas Mitzvah. But consider the following statement. Elimelech, we know, is the leader of the Jewish people at that time. He's a prominent individual. He goes to Moab. Why is he called Elimelech? So say Chazal, because Elimelech means Eli Tovo Malchus. Kingship will come to me. In the good old days, which weren't always so good, how did you create alliances and connect with kings in foreign countries? Through marriage. So Rabbi Fischer says, so Elimelech has these two sons. He's a prominent individual. He's, so to speak, the king of Israel. He's the closest to the king of Israel that they have. He's the shofet at that time. He leaves Eretz Yisrael. He goes to Moab. Chazal do tell us this part, that Rus and Arpah are the daughters of Eglon Melech Moab. They are the daughters of the king of Moab. The prominent individual, Elimelech, approaches Eglon Melech Moab and says, Shalom Aleichem, I just moved into town. Let us make an alliance between the Jews and the Moabim. And the way we're going to make this alliance is that you have two young daughters. For argument's sake, let's say they're 10, right? You know, you have these two young 10-year-old daughters. I have these two 15-year-old boys. Let's marry them off one to another. And that way we'll create somewhat of an alliance between Klal Yisrael and Moab. Again, in 2019, this doesn't sit so well with us, but back then, that it would have been the most ordinary, normal thing in the world, you know, to create such an alliance, you know, notwithstanding the ages of the children. Oh, so one second. So now, okay, so Eglon Melech Moab says, again in this scenario, he says to Elimelech, fine, you know, sounds good. So Elimelech then says, there's one more piece to all of this. You know, my sons are not allowed to marry non-Jews. We'll need your daughters to convert prior to the marriage. Right? Okay. They're 10. So the gerus of these two daughters is the gerus of ketanos, of women, of girls who are underage. As we said before, the gerus of a katan is something which can be undone when the child reaches the age of majority. So they convert, they marry Machlon and Kilion. Machlon and Kilion pass away, and let's say, for argument's sake, they pass away right around the time that the girls are 12. So now the girls have a choice. They can either embrace their Yiddishkeit, which was foisted upon them as ketanos, or they can choose to reject it. It's halakhically appropriate if they choose to reject it, because after all, they only entered into this as ketanos. They can continue with their Yiddishkeit, or they can reject their Yiddishkeit. It's the one time that a ger, after the gerus, has the opportunity to either keep going with the program or to veer away from the program. So Naomi sits down with her daughters-in-law and says, look, and again, you know, picture the scene. You know, Naomi is sitting down with her 12-year-old daughters-in-law, and she says, look, you can continue in the path of Torah and mitzvot and come with me back to Eretz Yisrael where you will live like a pauper, right, as far as they know. You know, and by the way, you're the daughters of Eglon Melech Moab, you're not used to living like a pauper. Or you have the choice, halachically, to go back to your nation and to your gods. No hard feelings. If you want to do that, that's fine. No problem. So that's a halakhically legitimate choice that Naomi is presenting to Rus and Arpah at that particular point. It's the greatness of Rus that she says, I want to go ahead with this anyway. And that then seals the gerus that she had prior to her marriage to Machlon. And although Chazal are critical of Arpah for turning back, right? But they're critical not in the sense that, you know, she had to keep going with Naomi. She didn't have to keep going with Naomi. But the critical in the sense that once you're already exposed to this lifestyle, you know, how come it was so easy for you to just turn your back on it? But that's more of a moral criticism than a halachic criticism. Halachically, she had every right, you know, to turn back. Right, right. So again, you know, maybe it speaks poorly of your character traits, but in other words, it's not as if there was something halachically wrong with Arpa's decision to go back to Moab. Again, she had the unique ability to uproot the gerus that she had done. It's essentially conditional gerus. Right, right. So the way that this would go forward is that you would then say that the, you know, the gerus works retroactively, which again, so Rabbi Fisher points out in his work, this is a little bit where he and Rav Sternbach you know, danced around this issue a little bit. There's a discussion in Rishonim when the ger katan, you know, the child, you know, now accepts mitzvahs at the age of 12 or 13. Does that mean that that child is now a ger going forward? Or does that make the child a ger retroactively? Right? Again, that's also a big discussion. If we assume that the gerus works retroactively, which is not something we're making up over here, that's a position that Rishonim have. If we assume that the gerus works retroactively, so then Rus really was married to Mahlon halachically, because she converted before she married Mahlon. Now the status of that conversion was always sort of in abeyance, but once she accepted mitzvahs at the age of 12, so retroactively it made her conversion 100% solid, and retroactively it made her marriage to Mahlon 100% solid. But yet by the same token, when Arpa rejected her gerus, so it meant retroactively she had done nothing. In other words, the power of their respective conversions was totally dependent on the decision that they would make at the age of 12. So if you go with that approach, so then you really do have your cake and eat it too. In other words, the indications in Chazal and the Rishonim that they converted before the marriage to Mahlon and Kilyon are correct, and the indications in Chazal that they convert, that Ruth only converted once she was ready to go back to Eretz Yisrael with Naomi, is also correct. There was a conversion that was conditional, and the validity of that conversion was all hanging on the decision that Ruth and Naomi, that Ruth and Arpa rather, would respectively make once they hit the age of 12, which again we're suggesting, Rabbi Fisher is suggesting, is right around the time that they're ready to go back to Eretz Yisrael. You know, they're weighing that decision to go back to Eretz Yisrael with Naomi. Just finally, just to put a little bit of a human touch on this scenario, so Rabbi Fisher says, you know, it's striking if you read Megillas Rus just on the pshat level, that the relationship between Naomi and Ruth is far more than a mother-in-law daughter-in-law relationship. It's really like a mother-daughter relationship, right? I mean, it's a very, very close relationship. Now, says Rabbi Fisher, if this scenario that we're suggesting is correct, namely that Ruth married Mahlon as a girl, as a little girl, and that, you know, she was with Naomi, you know, from the time that she was a little girl and kind of grew up with Naomi being a mother figure to her, it's understandable how Naomi wasn't simply the shviger. I mean, she was really, in a very real sense, Ruth's mother. I mean, again, she certainly played that role. I'm sorry? Right, right. So in other words, that the strength of the bond between Naomi and Ruth need not necessarily be a function of the fact that Ruth converted and married Mahlon when she was very, very young, but it fits. It fits the scenario. The scenario makes sense in the context of the pshat of the psukim. You know, if we assume that, you know, Ruth wasn't 25 when she married Mahlon, if we assume that she was more like 9 or 10, you know, when she married Mahlon, which again would have been very common, you know, back at that time. So, you know, the whole relationship between Ruth and Naomi is easier to understand, you know, like that. Right, you moved into the house, right, and you became part of the family. Right.
Melech jumped ship and left Eretz Yisrael, his status as the shofet and head of Klal Yisrael still relevant?
Well, I guess it was relevant in Moav. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you know, I don't know what he would have been had he gone back to Eretz Yisrael at that point. Well, in other words, right.
But he had money.
Right.
He had,
I guess, you know, this status even as an expat, which is essentially what he was. Right.
Well, what is happening?
Yeah.
Live. And when Ruth was given the choice, she would have said, you know, I want to be Jewish, but I want a divorce. And would she have been able to marry a Kohen then? Or not?
No, so she's a Gioris. Now, one way or the other, she's a Gioris, right? So in other words, they're... I don't know how many Kohanim there were running around Moab, so I mean, you know,
But first of all, I think that all these things are nice to dissect, but I think the real power of the story is that Ruth was a very different individual than she was not an ordinary
Yeah.
So the whole story is because she was so extraordinary, as you can see.
No, 100%.
These other things are like details.
Right.
And I didn't want to say, because I don't want to open a can of worms because I've got the papers, but in reality, when they married off Princess Di, it was not much different than this. Because a 12-year-old, in those, even a 12-year-old 100 years ago, was almost a woman. They baked, they stood
right.
on a little stool, and did, they already were like a small adult.
Right. Right.
We now we have a long childhood that didn't
exist
before this century. But even in, now they didn't do it anymore, and they let those princes marry anybody.
Right.
But Princess Di was Woodhood would get to marry an old man, basically.
Right.
And she was a little nursery school
right.
teacher.
So right.
it's not
yeah.
unusual in higher circles,
yeah.
even in this day and age. And if you meet people from Iran and Iraq, Jewish
yeah.
people will tell you. They marry them off very,
yeah.
very... I work with someone.
Yeah.
We married, I think, at 12. I mean, it
yeah.
really...
So
it's
I,
not an unusual...
I agree with both points.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree
but
with
I
the...
the real story is yeah. that she was an incredible...
No, 100%. No disagreement on that point. All we're trying to do over here is just to work out some of the technical details of the story. Right. Right. So... Right. Okay, so this is one approach in trying to, again, have our cake and eat it too. A second approach, which I want to present somewhat briefly, was suggested by one of my rabbis, Rabbi Zvulun Charlap. He should be well. He wrote this in an article a number of years back, and they just reprinted, they put out a beautiful sefer of all the Divrei Torah, which he wrote over the years, called the Shefa Yamim. So in that sefer, he makes the following suggestion with regard to Rus and Machlon. We may have heard of the Rogatchover Gaon of Yosef Rosen, who lived in Dvinsk towards the beginning of the 20th century. There was a reason they called him the Rogatchover Gaon. He was, by anybody's standards, brilliant off the charts. I mean, he was one of the Gaonim of Lithuania at that time, who famously would get postcards with shilas from all over the world, and he was famous for his sharpness as well as for his brevity. He would write back, you know, on the postcard. I mean, one thinks of Chaim Kanievsky, Bodo L'Chaim, you know, in our own day, you know, writing back, you know, three words on the postcard, you know, that are supposed to answer the entire question. So the Rogatchover, again, was known for his brilliance as well as for his brevity. The Rogatchover, in a different context, makes the following suggestion about Geirus. Writes the Rogatchover, let's say you have a Geirus process that has multiple steps in it. Like, to take an example, when a man is preparing for Geirus, we know there's at least a two-step process. The man has to undergo a bris milah, and then after the surgery of the bris milah heals, so then the man has to go into the mikvah. At what point does the man become Jewish? Right, so the Gemara is pretty clear that you know, the Geirus only takes place after the person goes to the second step, goes to the mikvah. In other words, if he goes and has a bris milah and then decides, you know what, this isn't really for me, okay, he's not half Jewish, he's not Jewish, you know, and it ain't over till it's over, as we said before. But once he goes into the mikvah, at what point is he considered to be Jewish? So the Rogatchover argues that at the point at which he goes into the mikvah, the Geirus works retroactively from the point of the Milah. In other words, although if he only does the Bris Milah without going to the mikvah, he's not Jewish, once he goes through the final step in a process, the Geirus is effective retroactively from the first step in the process. Similarly, suggests the Rogatchover, let's say a person were to immerse for the purposes of Geirus, but the person did not accept the mitzvahs properly at that time. You know, a person undergoes a pro forma Geirus procedure, but, you know, they're not looking to be frum. You know, they're being mekabel, the basic tenets of secular Judaism. They're going to have bagels and lox. They're going to give to Federation. You know, they're going to accept upon themselves all of the basic tenets of secular Judaism without necessarily committing to Torah mitzvahs. And then at some point later, after the Tevilah, the person says, you know, I should really keep Shabbos. I should really keep kosher. I should really, you know, accept the mitzvahs upon myself. So there too, the Rogatchover says that when the person is makabel the mitzvahs, when the person accepts the mitzvahs, the geirus works retroactively from the time that they went to the mikvah. Even though the time they went to the mikvah, they had not yet accepted the mitzvahs, and that wouldn't be good in its own right, but the later addition of an important point of the process makes the geirus work retroactively from the first point. Right. It would work retroactively. Right. It could make things very, very interesting. Let's put it that way. Right. Exactly.
It is a process. Till you actually, I've spoken to people, till you actually feel Jewish could be even 10 or 20 years.
Right, so feeling.
Married and living and having children, but that feeling, like the way we feel, we read the newspaper, oh my gosh, till
right.
you really feel this.
Right.
Well, this is, even for ourselves, being Jewish is a journey.
Right, that's true. That's true, but again, you know, the geirus, the effectiveness of the geirus process is defined by certain very concrete acts. In other words, you know, we're not talking about the feeling of identifying with the Jewish people, again, which is a very difficult thing to really, you know, assess or quantify, but in a very, very formal sense, you know, did the person undergo what is required of being Jewish, namely mila for a man, tevila?
That's why I understand why he's saying that even if once he makes that decision, that's what I mean. The way he said, once he makes that decision, even after the mila, that's what I'm trying to say, because it is a process.
Right, okay.
I think he's understanding that person's going through.
So the Rogatchover suggests that might be the answer to understanding Rus and Machlam. Let's say that Rus and Orpah underwent a low-grade conversion prior to marrying Machlon and Kilian, meaning they went to a mikvah, you know, they agreed to be Jewish, but without really accepting the mitzvahs properly, right? In other words, unfortunately, they went through a conversion that is not so different than many conversions which have done historically, you know, in the United States and other places, a conversion which, you know, pro forma goes through the motions, but is not really the real deal. Then, subsequently, so, you know, is that considered to be legitimate? No, it's not considered to be legitimate. And Orpah has every right to walk away from such a conversion, you know, as if it never happened. Now, Machlon and Kilian pass away. Naomi sits down with Ruth and Orpah and says, look, you know, the conversion that you guys went through before marrying Machlon and Kilian is not really worth all that much, let's be honest. So, you know, Rabosai, you know, if you want to go back to Moav, feel free. Orpah says, you know, you're offering me to go back to Moab? Fine. Ruth says, no, I know that the conversion I went through was not really so legitimate, but now I'm prepared, having seen the Jewish lifestyle, to accept the true lifestyle of Torah and mitzvahs. And that's what the Gemara says. Naomi said to Ruth, you know, you have to do this mitzvah and that mitzvah. So Ruth is mekabel al mitzvah. She accepts the mitzvahs at that point. Says the Rogatchover, that now retroactively infuses the tevila that she underwent before marrying Machlon and makes it retroactively into a good conversion. Is that a chiddush? Yes, it's a tremendous chiddush. But it's a rocket shot. Right. Yeah. So again, you know, in actual practice, is that what would happen? Yes, 100%. But So in practical terms, 100%, 1,000%. In practical actual terms, if something like that were to happen today, we would say, okay, go immerse in the mikvah over again. But in other words, in terms of, you know, I don't think we accept the Rogatchover's chiddush in terms of practical halacha, but in terms of the Rogatchover, but in terms of understanding Megillah's Rus, it's a fascinating chiddush that can help reconcile everything.
What really Jewish life looked like, and they
didn't
realize what was involved.
Right. Right. They understood it, and Orpah said, "I don't want this," and Ruth said, "I do want this."
But when they married, they didn't want it.
Right. So again, what the Rogatchover is doing is saying something very similar to Rabbi Fisher, insofar as the conversion is ratified retroactively, but for a different reason. Rabbi Fisher wants to suggest it's because of their age. The Rogatchover wants to suggest that it's because of this unique chiddush that a substandard Geirus, which subsequently is infused with Kabbalah's Ol Mitzvahs, retroactively can become an acceptable Geirus, and that would render Rus retroactively as being Eishes Maslam. In any case, what we certainly see from all this discussion of Megillas Rus is that it's complicated. and you know, even just the halakhic implications of this require a lot of study. I want to thank everybody for a wonderful semester, so to speak. We look at a wonderful Yom Tov, and Bez Hashem, we look forward to resuming in the early fall.